Hello, this is Marshall Poe of the New Books Network. The NBN is run by volunteers, but we do have expenses. If you'd like to support us, please go to any New Books Network website. There you can make a tax-deductible contribution. Just click the Donate to the NBN link and follow the instructions. Alternatively, you can click the Amazon link before you make your Amazon purchases. Since the NBN is a member of the Amazon Affiliates Program, Amazon pays us a small fee for referrals. Whether you can help us out or not, thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy the following interview.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'll be talking to Ollie Mould about his new book, Urban Subversion, The Creative City, which was published by Routledge in 2015. So welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm talking to Ollie Mould, who is a lecturer in the Geography Department at Royal Holloway, University of London, about his new book, Urban Subversion and the Creative City, which was published by Routledge in 2015. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi.
This is a really fascinating book. It's unbelievably well-timed in terms of the things that are going on, not just in London, but much more globally in the contemporary city. And really usefully for an academic book, it's not just kind of critical, but also it gives us a bit of a vision of how we might do our cities really differently. So I suppose the place to start is, could you tell me a bit about the kind of process of writing the book and where the ideas for the book came from?
Yeah, well, I have been looking at creativity within an urban context pretty much since the start of my PhD, really. And there was a slight funny trajectory because after the PhD, I took a position in what was essentially a policy unit in a London-based creative industries think tanky sort of thing. And I've seen the creative industries develop from a political perspective and how that links in with some of the urban development processes that are going on at the time. And as I was doing that, I kind of became more and more aware of the ways in which these processes had a sort of political angle, and they were being used to develop a particular kind of city. I ended up then after that going back into academia and developing these ideas critically. So I really wanted to write something which was a critical take at some of these creative city ideas, developing on the critiques that were going on at the time in geography, particularly, you know, Jamie Peck's ideas and all the sort of the discourses that were very much going against the ideas of the creative city and the creative class. But I was also looking at some subcultural stuff. I was interested in those people that were doing things in the city creatively that perhaps not doing it commercially. So, you know, I was looking at particular kinds of subcultures and parkour, skateboarding, street art, urban exploration, those kinds of things. The politics of these people fascinated me. And I saw them as really doing creativity in the city, but in a very different way to which I had sort of seen from a political perspective when I had that one of those positions in London. So I was really interested in what these guys were doing because I saw that as an inherently creative act, but a creativity that was very different to the sort of official rhetoric. So I wanted to write something which posited the two together and kind of really championed the creativity that was being done in a much more visceral sort of you know, subversive way, I guess. So that's really where the idea came from. And so in writing the book, it was really, you know, trying to articulate a lot of the debates and narratives that I've been talking about really for the last, well, 5 or 6 years before that, really. So it was an attempt to kind of collate all those ideas and bring it together in a nice, coherent narrative.
Yeah, and the book captures that really nicely, actually, because it juxtaposes the kind of the part one of, you know, this is the policy imagination with the part two of, well, here's actually what's going on, that presents, you know, if not an outright alternative, but certainly a set of practices that, you know, gives us a different vision of how we might use the city. And one of the ways you do this really early on in the book is by talking about the story of Man on Wire, which was a kind of an urban intervention in, I think it's late 70s. And then was recently a documentary, and then very recently was a film as well.
Yes, that's right. Yes. I read about what Emmanuel Petit did, and it struck me as just one of those kind of urban subversion performances, if you like, kind of par excellence. It was just, you know, the guy had an innate skill, and he intervened in the city, and he did it completely covertly as the film's document. Yes, he was performing, and I think there's an element of the kind of spectacle to it, which, you know, is kind of problematic. But when I read the book and I saw the documentary, and indeed the most recent film, it's obvious that he had a real desire to do it. It was like his want. There was something just within him that kind of he felt compelled to do it. And I think that as you'll know, as the book progresses, I talk a lot about desire, you know, from Deleuze and Guattari's idea. And it really struck me as a good way to premise that idea of desire being an inherently creative act or creative process. So that's why I use that vignette, because for me, not only is it a highly spectacular version of what I'm talking about in the book, but also it really foregrounds it in a notion of, you know, it was his desire to do it, and it's kind of a really willful sort of act. And I think that sets up a lot of the ideas, and particularly in the latter half of the book. So that's really why it's there, because I think it's just a really, really nice, good, sort of perfect example of what I'm talking about.
Actually, you mentioned desire and the kind of broader theoretical framework that's placed within. I wonder if you could say a bit about the theorists that are important to your analysis before we get into kind of thinking about definitions of creative cities. So obviously Deleuze, but also De Certo are really important to the book.
Yes, they are. Yes. I mean, I think there's a certain amount of, a theoretical postulation, I guess. I'm trying to think of the ways in which creativity can be, or as urban subversion can be best thought of through a social theoretical lens. Now, the most obvious, or the most kind of appropriate, I guess, is Deleuze's ideas, particularly of desire production and lines of flight, because it, you know, I think it really captures that idea of trying to break away from conformity, trying to, denormalize, really, trying to break away from a sort of hegemonic idea. So it really felt like a decent and a very appropriate language, really, to articulate kind of the kinds of things which I was seeing, these subversive acts, particularly from the subcultural perspective, but also the sort of little things that people were doing. Some of the vignettes I talk about, the soldier mat and everything else. I think there's, you know, it just to me seemed like a very appropriate language to use, and it explained the reasonings behind it as well. So Deleuze and his ideas are particularly influential in that respect. De Certo, he very famous for his Walking the City chapter. Obviously there's parallels there, because he starts the chapter by going up the top of the World Trade Centers, which is what I do in my book as well, going up the top of the World Trade Center, and similarly at the end as well, and not the Trade Centers, but to a similar point in the skyline. So De Certo's ideas, I think, speak to that as well, that idea of being tactical, kind of little sort of pinpricks in the, he talks about the strategies, like tactics within a strategy. And, you know, it just sort of rung true that a lot of what these people are doing, they're trying to puncture that sort of large scale kind of behemoth, if you like, or which is a creative city or, the global city. And it, you know, these theories really articulate the reasoning very, very well. And they have their kind of problems, like, to a certain extent. Doreen Matthey does a wonderful critique of De Certo's work in her book For Space, and I think there's a lot of credence in that. But from the stuff that I was seeing, and the ways in which these people were doing it, it really struck a chord. I also look at John Baudrillard's stuff a bit, when he talks about the object, and he talked about the metaphysics of objects with form and functionality, and I think that again was an interesting way, particularly to think about the non-human aspect of these things. You know, a lot of these urban subversion practices involve reappropriating the urban environment, like taking something like a park bench or a wall and turning it into something else, like something to grind or skateboard on, or to jump over in a parkour performance. So Bojar's stuff about kind of releasing the functions of objects, I think, is important here as well. So I've taken sort of bits and pieces of theoretical arguments, which I think fitted what I was looking at. You know, I appreciate these sit in a larger kind of mandate, and a lot of these, which often can be conflicting. But to me, I thought that these particular kinds of idioms really, you know, really shone through in the work that I was doing and in the things that I was seeing. So that's why I've used them.
So you mentioned the kind of like the behemoth of the creative city,
yeah,
and how, you know, these theorists were useful to you to kind of make sense of how people's practices are challenging or transforming, mm, particular urban settings. What is this this idea then? What do we mean by the creative city?
Well, I mean, it's a great question, because I think that it's often changing. I mean, you know, we can chart the language back to 1995 and Charles Landry and Biocchini, when they wrote the sort of toolkits for the creative city. It was a demos paper. And, you know, back then it was really an idea to try and plug into the new economy. There's sort of, you know, a lot of the shifts and the global shifts in the way the economy was operating, you know, to the creative industries, to knowledge economies, to high tech, to biotech, to, you know, to industries that much more predicated upon human capital. You know, this is an idea which is not, you know, this is economic geography 101, right? So, and I guess what Landry and Biocchini were trying to do is to articulate an urban system which plugs into that, like that makes the most of this, the resource which fuels these economies, which is essentially creativity, people's, you know, the human ingenuity. So from an etymological perspective, that's kind of where it came from. In 2015, in the intervening, you know, 20, 30 years, I mean, it's gone from something which was very much a kind of, like I say, just thinking of an urban environment which stimulates creativity, to something which is much more hard, much more physical, much more, you know, they're building all sorts of large-scale developments, media cities, cultural quarters, you know, large-scale gated communities, which are designed specifically to try and stimulate this creativity at any cost, because it's obviously seen as the sort of the fairy dust which makes cities grow. So, you know, to me, the creative city there's soft policies to it and there's hard policies to it, and I try and outline those in the book. And it's constantly changing, it's constantly adapting, and I think now, you know, it's become so amorphous, because the notion of creativity has sort of bled into all different factors of the economy, that, you know, the creative city is something which you can see in shopping developments. You know, people try and kind of talk about stimulating the creative milieu, and, you know, they might have hot desks in there or space for artists or whatever. So it's become so ingrained in urban development that, you know, when people are developing cities, I think it's very difficult to not talk about the creative city, because they've become so much part of how cities are developing.
Yeah, and in the book you talk about how it's dependent on a couple of key ideas, some are to, yeah, do with, I guess, visions of particular kinds of workers or a particular kind of population around this idea of a creative class, and then others are to do with, as you've described, the kind of the harder policies of, mm, media cities or cultural quarters, which are two examples you use. So I wonder if you could kind of unpack those ideas about both what the hard policies are,
yeah,
and also who the kind of the ideal type worker is.
Yeah. So, like you say, I think that, you know, I try and split them into these two, like hard and soft. And I think looking at them and sort of having worked with a number of cities and trying to develop a sort of creative city policy or environment, it's, you know, I've noticed that there's often these two sort of tools. So there's a soft side of it, and, you know, these are often quite small scale to a certain extent, but they're sort of more tacit. So, you know, I use the example of Sydney and their branding exercise. You know, I was in Sydney for a bit, and I kind of remember speaking to people and actually seeing this process come about. And, you know, it was really an attempt to brand the city in a very particular way. And this, again, this is in 2005, 2006, right after the back of, you know, the success of Richard Florida's book, Rise of the Creative Class. And we'll talk about him in a minute. But it was at a time when, you know, creativity was the thing to do. And, you know, it was all about trying to make your city more creative, however that was defined, and in this case, relatively badly. But, you know, so these cities were implementing these soft policies. So they were branding cities in a particular way, you know, spending a lot of money on advertising it globally, you know, going to real estate fairs and sort of saying, oh, yeah, come to our city. We've got all these wonderful tax breaks, for example. You know, my PhD was on the film industry, and there's a real desire for many cities to give tax breaks to these runaway productions to film in their city. So things like tax breaks, you know, little policy levers that can be pulled and twitched to entice creative activity. So in this case, you know, a lot of creative industries activities are film, computer games is big at the moment, trying to get tax breaks for computer games industries. You know, because these industries are seen as very footloose and they can really go anywhere, it doesn't, you know, cities can, or regions can don't have to do much to be seen to attract to them. So tax breaks, branding, you know, they don't have to do a great deal of kind of hard infrastructural building, although they do. You know, as I said, the second bit of it is the hard stuff. And when I went around a number of different cities, it was amazing that they were trying to, you know, build these massive infrastructural sites. You know, I started off looking at media cities. So, you know, I was based in Salford for a time, and that's kind of how I got into it. And the media city up in Salford, you know, there was, when they were building that, when they were sort of looking to formulate it, they went to Seoul, they went to Dubai, they went to Copenhagen, and they looked at the media cities that were there, and they essentially modeled them on these other media cities. So, you know, they were seen as, okay, well, if we build it, they will come. And obviously the media city in the UK, that was embedded in a much more complicated sort of process of the BBC's relocation. But essentially, you know, it was an attempt to build a creative city from scratch, which is what they did in Dubai and Seoul and in Copenhagen. So, you know, it's an attempt to kickstart this process, to sort of short circuit the very, I guess, long process of trying to wait for these people to come and build it up from the ground up. You know, none of that. Let's just build it. You know, let's just pour loads of money into it and build it and hopefully kickstart the economy that way. So it's this kind of dual nature of the hard and the soft policies, which are the characteristics of the creative city for me.
And what about then this kind of almost sort of godfather figure now who's both, you know, embedded in so many policy documents, and is also at the heart of kind of critiques as well, Richard Florida.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I kind of devote a chapter to the creative class simply because I think that, you know, I'm trying to reflect the weight of critique that has gone against his stuff. I mean, it's an interesting idea because, you know, there's a lot to admire in Richard Florida's work to a certain extent. I mean, I think that he's attempting to, you know, shift the way that sort of cities are being done and the way that the economy is kind of structured. But unfortunately, he does that in a way which kind of is, you know, just sort of emperor's new clothes. It just dresses up the problems in a slightly different way. And I think that that's the nub of the many, many critiques is essentially that it's just a sort of, it's a redressing of the same old problem, just slapping a label creativity on it. And you're right. His work has become so popular and so ingrained in this rhetoric that it's difficult to not talk about. It's difficult to, you know, to not to talk about it when you're doing a critique of the creative city, because it's just so ingrained in it. When I was going to around these other cities and looking at having interviews with people in their offices, there's always a copy of the creative class on their bookshelf. There was all, and I pointed out, and and I'd asked them, say, how influential were those ideas, and they would wax lyrical about it, you know, because it was written in such a way as to plug into these people's sorts of mindsets, plug into the urban managers, the policymakers, the think tanks, you know, and it was lapped up. And I think that, you know, and that's why it's so influential. It became very, very quickly ingrained in just everything that was being done at that time, and still is to a certain extent. And so critiquing that is important, because obviously it carries with it all these issues which I outline, the kind of nature of, you know, it creates a service class, you know, massive gentrification, and it needs to be, you know, tackled. It needs to be critiqued. And I think it's getting through. And, you know, often you'll see now that people like Jamie Peck and others, the larger critiques of the Florida's work, are actually talked about in a similar way within these sort of policy documents. But really, I like to sort of think of the creative city or the creative class idea as kind of dead, but still dominant. You know, it might have been critiqued, but the ideas have kind of filtered through, and they've just been kind of manifest in a slightly different way. So I take a bit of time in dissecting that, because there's lots of different things that are wrong with it, and you can dissect it. So that's why I kind of dwelt on that, because it's just become so influential. And like I say, it's kind of dispersed now. It's almost as if it, you know, it's his name is gone, but his ideas are kind of multiplied and kind of spread virus-like through the urban managerial system. It's difficult to kind of pinpoint it, but it kind of needs to be done, really, to make sure it doesn't continue to spread, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, and the book pivots around that point, actually. There's quite a useful sort of 2-3 page almost list of the problems and issues with this, you know, sort of thinking about homogenizing spaces, you know, touristic, unrealistic visions of the city, as you say, you know, a kind of a vision of a essentially a kind of a service class. And the pivot takes us to what you call lines of flight away from that version of the creative city. And you give examples of things like situationism, the flâneur, this sort of thing. So can you summarize what these lines of flights are?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, this is, comes back to the number of what I was talking about. The creativity idea for me really is more in line with these ideas, you know, the situationist ideas and stuff. And that's why I think it's really important to posit them first, because a lot of the stuff that Guy Debord and you know, unitary urbanism and Constance New Babylon, what they were trying to do is actually, I think anyway, talk about a creative city. They were trying to talk about ways in which people are interacting or being proactive in their city rather than kind of being passive consumers. And, you know, Debord's stuff about the spectacle is all about the kind of passive consumption of society. So to me, it really struck, it, you know, these things are inherently about creativity, about urban creativity. And so, and it, you know, yes, these things were being talked about in geography and in other areas, but I didn't really see a particularly strong narrative that was using them as a critique of Richard Florida's stuff and the creative city more generally. So that's why I did it. To me, they seem like an obvious way of critiquing it. And yes, it's about, you know, that's what unitary urbanism and situationism is really all about, like sort of, you know, being, you know, tactical, I guess, like puncturing that city, like trying to sort of break out of a particular kind of social slumber, I guess, and just doing things which give you an experience of the city which is new, which is different. You know, that is the creative process to me. It's like creating new things which don't exist, and the creative city doesn't do that at all. It kind of just replicates what already exists in just a new way, in a kind of, you know, in a slightly different way. So I didn't really, in the researching the book, I mean, I saw, you know, the situationist stuff and all these wonderful examples of unitary urbanism were there, and they were being used, but like I say, not as a critique to the creative city. So that's why I put them in there, because I felt that it allowed us to, or allowed me to kind of say, look, this stuff's already there. You know, these kind of social critiques and artistic critiques are there. They're just not being utilized perhaps in the way that they could be. So that's why that's there, to really kind of alert people that this stuff's here. It's been going on for ages, and it's really, really, really creative. It's really good. And it really helps to enliven what creativity in the city is.
The sort of manifestations of these practically, I guess, you know, that the lines of flight are both kind of theoretical but with practical elements, but the real kind of story of practices comes in your discussion of urban subversion. And I think there are two things I'd like to know about that. One is, what is urban subversion? But also, how does it work in London with the story of South Bank?
Well, what is urban subversion? Well, I think that it's, for me, it's a process. And I think I talk about it as kind of a verb and not a noun. It's not, you know, to me, urban subversion is constantly seeking out different ways of interacting with your city. Now, this is where I talk about Baudrillard's stuff. And you know, he talks about functionality overriding the function of an object. So, you know, within an urban context, a park bench, for example, you know, it's been built for us to sit on. But, you know, if you use it to skateboard on, if you use it to jump over, or you use it to stand on to chant political slogans, you know, those, you're using that bench differently. You're releasing new functions that are there, but they're hidden by the functionality, by a kind of technocratic kind of Lefebvrean functionality. So urban subversion is, for me, is about seeking out these new functions of the city, of kind of the terrain or the sort of the physicality of the city, I guess. And also within yourself, you know, thinking about, you know, changing your behavior, changing the ways in which you interact with the city, you know, not being that, you know, not kind of being that passive consumer, not being that kind of, you know, the routinized person that interacts with the city in a very banal way, like kind of talking about it, looking at the city in a different light. And so urban subversion is really just about trying to do that. And, you know, the reason I talk about particular kinds of subcultures is because these people are doing it in, have been doing it for a while and doing it in really interesting ways. And they built up particular cultures and subcultures around that. So skateboarding, urban exploration, parkour, you know, these are sort of ossified groupings of people who have been reappropriated the urban environment in interesting ways. And yes, they've built up these kinds of identifiable subcultures, which can be co-opted. They can, you know, have internal kinds of problems with gender politics and class politics. And, you know, parkour is a good example of being kind of, you know, selling out to a certain extent. But within that, there are still kinds of subversive elements. And the reason I wanted to talk about the South Bank Centre in this is because, and the skateboarders there, is because for me, it's a, you know, a really viable and really sort of good example of the ways in which urban subversion comes about in the city. Because, and it's very timely, of course, because it was, you know, happened in the sort of 18 months, well, happened in the time period I was writing this book, actually. So I felt that it was a, you know, really quite a sort of fresh angle on it. And the reason I think that they're engaging in urban subversion is because they were fighting for the subversive use of that space. Now, the history of the Undercroft and the history of skateboarding at the South Bank is very long and protracted, and, you know, it's not necessarily something we can go into now. There are plenty of resources online to look at that. But essentially, these people have been using the Undercroft space subversively for, you know, since the 70s. And, you know, the South Bank Centre have attempted to get rid of them on a number of occasions. They've turned off the lights. They've used it as a waste dump. They've put gravel down. And each time the skaters have overcome this, they've got together as a society, as a community, sorry, and made it skatable again. And, you know, we can talk about the kind of ways in which it's kind of, you know, skateboarding has become a subculture that has been commercialized and stuff, but there is an ethos of this place. You know, I used to skate it as a kid, and, you know, I've spoken to a lot of people who've used it, and it really is a place that kind of oozes subversion, because they're using it because they want to continue this process of skateboarding, which is about community. It's about, you know, youth engagement. You know, there's all the sorts of things which I guess at the South Bank, what the South Bank Centre wanted to turn into, wouldn't give. You know, turning it into retail outlets and, you know, kind of a more prescribed version of youth engagement around, you know, high culture. They were reacting against that. And I think that was a very subversive process, because they were trying to maintain a sort of a non-commercial or a sort of anti-corporate agenda. And, you know, yes, there was problems with it. And I guess you could say it kind of frayed around the edges at times. And it, you know, it sort of sometimes spilt over into kind of branding and imageability and stuff. But I don't think that's really the point. I think that it was allowing the Undercroft space to continue to flourish, to continue to kind of allow it to subvert people's behavior, because that's what it does. You go there and it's a very different kind of place to what surrounds it. And I think it was worth saving for that, because it's like gold dust in a city like London, where these kinds of spaces are, you know, they're disappearing all the time. It was really, really important to save it, because it doesn't adhere, or at least it problematizes that creative city, corporate, commercialized landscape. And I think for that, it was really, really important that it was worth saving.
Yeah, particularly that part of central London as well, which had seen, yes, you know, kind of unbelievable levels of urban transformation over the last 10 to 20 years.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I use this rather crass term, which I kind of almost regret using. It's a sliver of subversive spaces, really, because you look at it and you can say, okay, well, there's skateboarding there. There's kind of Leake Street's got the street arts, the legal street arts site, which is a really interesting case study all by itself. And then you've got, you know, the Vauxhall Walls, which is where people went to sort of practice parkour. And then, you know, I guess urban exploration, Battersea, although not now, of course, but, you know, the Battersea Power Station was, you know, speaking to explorers, was almost like a training ground. It was like ground zero for urban exploration. So, you're right. And these spaces are disappearing. And, you know, the ability to do this stuff is becoming more and more difficult. And I think that's, you know, that's detrimental to a city like London, because you're kind of squeezing out sort of more, you know, visceral creative practices. And that can only lead to, you know, that's I think a bad thing, because it reduces the kind of vitality, you know, reduces youth engagement, and it's you know, something that needs to be resisted.
Oh yeah, absolutely, and it's good, I think, to see this both theoretically, as you do in the second half of the book, but also to ground it in the much broader policy context that the start of the book does, because it suggests that these are not unique, singular and kind of unusual urban disputes. Actually, they're part of something much bigger and much more global. I wonder if we could conclude by thinking about the end of the book and the vision of a range of other types of creative city that you set forward: the industrial, the spectacularized, the activist, and the social. Obviously, you know, we don't need to go through them in great detail individually, but I wonder if you could say a bit about the kind of other visions of creative cities.
Yeah, well, yes, I mean, I posited these sort of four things as kind of thought experiments, really, and I was like, well, if we kind of took a particular strand of what urban subversion could be considered to be and followed it to its logical conclusion, what would that sort of city look like? And, you know, I think it's a useful exercise because it gets us to think about, you know, what would happen if we kind of carry down a particular path. So, yes, you know, they're obviously the first two, the industrial city and the sort of the spectacular cities, I guess, are sort of the more ones that we perhaps don't want to be. You know, I think that they're fairly, you know, I use fairly kind of negative language, I guess, when trying to think about it. And, you know, the stuff I've done around tactical urbanism feeds into that, because it's kind of, you know, I think that, given the nature of London in 2015 in particular, it's very difficult to be subversive without sort of immediate co-option or a sort of an immediate attempt to kind of be reappropriated by, you know, a rampant capitalist discourse, which is looking for subversion or new things to kind of to market. So it was an attempt to sort of think about what would a city like that look like if we kind of turned that up to 11? And, you know, that's kind of what the creative industrial city is. And you know, the other examples as well, the spectacularized, what would happen if there's, you know, completely mediated. So it's an attempt to sort of think about these how we follow these creative city ideas through. And I think, you know, it was an attempt to sort of say, look, these are perhaps cities we don't want to be in. I think you can probably tell from the way I've written it that, you know, I'm particularly influenced by Christiania in Copenhagen.
Yeah.
So I've been to a couple of times now, and I guess it, you know, maybe with a, you know, maybe being slightly romanticized about it, but I think that it's a very, very useful model of how to do, you know, to be a creative city, because it it uses sort of base level kind of laws, I guess. You know, I talk about no running and no hard drugs and all that sort of stuff. And it really creates an environment which, you know, is subversive. And what I mean by that, it's you know, it's difficult and it can be abrasive. And, you know, you go there and you do feel uncomfortable. But I think that it, over time, you realize that is all due to that's all because it's kind of trying to create something new. And it's trying to create these communities and these knowledges and subjectivities, which are far more beneficial than those that are created by the creative city around it, i.e. Copenhagen. So it, you know, it's an attempt to try and use these ideas and think about, well, can they be scaled up? And if they did, kind of what would they look like? You know, and it's really an attempt to sort of think about a creative city differently. Now, yes, you could argue that there's a sort of rose-tinted look at these things, but, you know, I think that they're important thought experiments to have, because if we don't do it, then it's, you know, we risk kind of falling back into the old habits. So that's what it's really about. It's just kind of trying to speculate and trying to see if these things can work.
And is this the kind of thing you're going to be continuing with in terms of a new book project?
Yes, I think so. Yes. I mean, there's, you know, I've been doing a lot of work recently around kind of the resistances to the anti-gentrification campaigns in London, you know, and particularly the sort of the creative responses to it. You know, there seems to be new ones every day that I find on Twitter and Facebook, and like new groups of people that are getting together to resist a particular kind of development. You know, I've been particularly involved with the Robin Hood Gardens and the Balfour Estate in East London. But there's South London and Brixton, and there's all over the city, and that's just London. You know, there's places in Birmingham and the rest of the UK and the rest of the world that are, you know, really struggling to maintain a life that they see as important to them in the face of these large scale changes. And I think that the cities, the sort of thought experiments that I outline at the end of this book, I think it's a worthwhile project in trying to flesh those out, in trying to think about them in a more, you know, in a more grounded way, and think about, look, what are the theoretical tools that will allow us to create a new discourse that will better resist these sort of large scale hyper gentrification processes. And that's really what the next aim is of, well, the next projects I've got are about, really, to think about ways in which we can create a new discourse, really, a new language about that. And I think that there's various other theoretical ideas that around that. I've been looking a bit about Sarah Ahmed's work on queer phenomenology, about objects and the sort of the way in which objects can, the agency of objects allow us, they have a kind of, the ability to kind of queer our behavior. And there's a material recalcitrance, which Jane Bennett talks about, which I think is a wonderful phrase that, you know, looking at the kind of the non-human parts of cities and how they affect us, you know, so there's lots of different kinds of theoretical strands, which I think are useful tools in creating a sort of more general or broader discourse, which will allow people to combat these gentrification processes. So yeah, so that's really what the plan is. How successful I'll be, I don't know. We'll see. But it's an exciting project, and one which I think is much needed.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I was talking to Ollie Mole about Urban Subversion and the Creative City, published by Routledge in 2015.